This is the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we conclude our series of interviews with the Democratic candidates for mayor of Philadelphia. State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams will join us in studio in just a little while. We'll also tell you about some changes coming to Filbert Street along the Reading Terminal Market. In about a year, this stretch of Philly roadway will be able to switch back and forth, becoming a pedestrian mall or road for vehicles depending on the need, following a trend across the world to make cities more pedestrian-friendly. We'll hear more from Anuj Gupta, general manager of the Reading Terminal Market. But first, New Jerseyans who are sexually abused as children will soon face fewer restrictions as they attempt to bring alleged abusers to court. Governor Phil Murphy has signed legislation which will extend the state's statute of limitations for civil lawsuits beginning in December. Nick Pugliese has been covering the story for WHYY and is here to fill us in. Welcome, Nick.
Happy to be here.
So this reworked statute will mark a fairly dramatic departure from the law as it stands now. Let's get some perspective. If a person was sexually abused as a child, what are the parameters for suing an alleged abuser currently, and what will they look like in December?
Yes. Yeah, so the current law says that survivors of sexual abuse have 2 years typically from making discovery. And that's the moment when they link, a negative coping mechanism they have in the present, depression, alcoholism, to their abuse. That moment is called discovery. And under current law, they have 2 years to bring a civil case. The advocates I've spoke to have said it typically takes till people are in their 50s to come forward until they feel ready to, bring a case like this. So 2 years is just woefully inadequate for a lot of people who have experienced the trauma of abuse.
And in December, it will look like what?
In December, people who were abused as children will have until they're 55 or 7 years from that moment of discovery, whichever is later. And adult victims will have 7 years from discovery. So it's a huge difference from where we are currently.
Quite a change. I don't know if you have this info at your fingertips, but do you know how long it took to get this approximately? That's a big change.
Advocates who were behind this bill have said they started working on it 20 years ago. It's been a long time in the making. And what changed ultimately, I think, was the grand jury report that came out in Pennsylvania. I think it reopened people's eyes to the fact that, we had this reckoning in the early 2000s, but there's still a lot of cover up and there's still a lot of survivors who haven't gotten justice.
That grand jury report in Pennsylvania spurred an investigation in New Jersey. What was it? It was last fall, right? State Attorney General Gerbier Graywall?
That's correct. And that's still going. I know there's been at least one criminal indictment under that. This law is about civil litigation, but lawyers I've spoken to have said it is possible for civil cases to lead to criminal investigations if lawyers make referrals based on the evidence that's dug up in these civil cases.
So, and again, just a civil and criminal and a person who is a survivor of sexual abuse, what is the difference as they're looking to go to court?
Well, a criminal case is brought by the state or federal prosecutors. The case has to be made, the evidence has to be presented beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil case, you only have to present a preponderance of the evidence to win. And it's brought by, of course, by the individual.
Sure.
So you have to build up the courage to actually, state your story again in a public venue.
Yeah.
You can also bring it confidentially. There are a number of people that go through civil cases over past abuse confidentially, so their name is not released into the public.
Nick, this reworked statute also allows victims to sue institutions. Tell us about that.
Yes. So if you can prove that, say, the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, transferred priests or troop leaders or whomever it may be, and they should have known better, they had evidence that of abuse, of a pattern of abuse, and they did not take steps to prevent it, they are liable under this law for damages, as is the individual that perpetrated the abuse.
Do you know if the Catholic Church or the Boy Scouts or other such organizations, which might be in the spotlight here, are cooperating with investigations with New Jersey into abuse?
They say they are. They have been vocally saying that victims deserve justice. They want to cooperate any way they can. They've said for years now that any report of abuse they get, they in turn forward to local prosecutors. The church here is in an interesting position. They have resisted this law for many years, I think. And it's not only it hasn't just been the church. A lot of different nonprofits are concerned about their financial exposure, and this will likely cause them to make a lot more payouts. Simultaneous to this law taking effect in December, the church, the Catholic Church in New Jersey, has set up an independent victims compensation fund, which is an alternative avenue for people to potentially get payouts from the church. It's up to the individual survivor to decide which may be the better avenue for them. There are differences that we may want to talk about here.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, so the Independent Victims Compensation Fund, it's run by the same folks that did the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. It's a lower burden of proof than a civil court. However, you don't get discovery that you would get in a civil case. And discovery is your ability to get documents from the church, from the Boy Scouts, from whatever institution you're going after that can show that they had information about your abuser, that they transferred him or her several times. And for a lot of families, that is the thing they want to know. How did this happen?
Yeah.
It fills in a lot of gaps of their knowledge of their personal histories and of, you know, what they experienced in their earlier years.
Still, it sounds, even though for survivors, this new legislation presents hope, it sounds like a mountain to climb. So probably the first step is to get a good attorney.
Even the attorneys I've spoken to have said the first step may be finding someone you trust to share your story with them. These experiences have been repressed by many people for decades. And there's no doubt that it is a mountain to climb to come forward with these allegations. But there is, I've witnessed a huge support group among other people that have been through these types of cases in years past and will be going forward now that this law, or when this law becomes active in December. So there are other people out there to lean on as well throughout this journey.
There's also a two-year window which will open to those who have not been able to sue because of the statute of limitations. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, this is another very significant aspect of this bill. If you tried to bring a case previously, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, decades ago, and you were prevented from doing so because the statute of limitations had expired, you will have a two-year window beginning December 1st to bring your case, regardless of when it happened. The only exception is if you had previously settled with an institution such as a church, you can't, you know, bring a second case against them. But for everyone else, this is a new opportunity for 2 years to bring a case.
We've been talking about people who were sexually assaulted as children. This legislation also addresses those who were abused as adults, but in a different way?
Well, everything we've spoken about applies to children and adults. And
okay.
In fact, the two-year window, as far as I understand it, is the first look-back law or the first window law that applies both to child survivors and adult survivors.
Okay.
So New Jersey is actually unique in that regard. The only difference is child survivors have until they're 55 or 7 years from discovery. Adults, it's just 7 years from discovery. So that could expire before they turn 55, for example.
Okay. Anything else we need to know about this legislation that you and I haven't covered here?
Just one thing that I thought was interesting is that, you know, how do you win a case? How do you prove a case of abuse that goes back decades? And I asked a few attorneys that, and one of the most interesting things I heard is, you know, first of all, there are documents that institutions are required to keep or reports they're required to fill out when they get allegations of abuse. One of the other most, the strongest pieces of evidence is prior allegations that may match up to yours. And those sorts of stories that other people have come forward with may help your case and vice versa. So there's sort of a network effect that comes from these sorts of cases, as sad as that is.
So overall, as an observer, I would guess that you would think that this is a huge step and an encouraging step forward for those who are sexually abused.
Yes, that's what they say. I mean, they've been fighting for this, as we said, for 20 years. And the joy on their faces, everyone had a celebratory lunch after the The bill was signed last week. So this is a big deal for those people.
All right, Nick Pugliese, before we let you go, let's do a quick follow-up on another story. In March on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, we did a segment on legislation that would legalize recreational marijuana in New Jersey. Legalization is a campaign promise of Governor Murphy's and had the support of legislative leaders, but there weren't quite enough votes in the Democratic legislature to push it through. So it looks as if Senate President Steve Sweeney is throwing in the towel on the legislative approach and instead is going to send the question of legal pot to the voters. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so my caveat here is this has changed 100 times in the last year, so that it could change again. But as of last week, as you said, Senate President Steve Sweeney came forward and said he wants to put it before voters in 2020.
Not in 2019.
Not in 2019, because this year is only an assembly election. That means lower turnout, older voters, more Republican voters, not the demographics that they think is going to get this through to the end. So he wants to do it in a presidential year. The Speaker of the Assembly is on board with that, and they can go around the governor to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot. They do not need Governor Murphy's input on this.
So we're talking about a constitutional amendment, not a straight up or down, yes or no. That sounds a bit more challenging, perhaps.
Well,
to get the job done.
It is an up or down, yes or no vote, but it would be voters would be voting whether to amend the Constitution to allow for legalized marijuana, essentially, is what it comes down to.
Do you have any, in your research, have you come across the reasons why they would go this route as opposed to just going, you know, why do they have to amend the Constitution in their minds?
My understanding of how ballot referendums work, and I'm no New Jersey constitutional scholar, the two types of ballot referendums we see are either a bond referendum to, say, $500 million for the libraries or a state building or something like that, or a constitutional amendment to dedicate funds to do this or that or something like marijuana. And we should say, in the meantime, in the next year and a half while we're waiting for the referendum, Senator Sweeney, Assembly Speaker Coughlin and others have said they want to move forward with an expansion of New Jersey's medical marijuana program, as well as a bill to expunge or overhaul how New Jersey expunges criminal records, both for marijuana convictions and other convictions. And as we said, over the weekend, there was another change. There's a bill being presented that would decriminalize possession up to 2 ounces of marijuana. It's not clear whether this has enough support to get through, but we could see some sort of halfway step towards decriminalization while we're waiting for legalization. So there's so many moving parts here. It's hard to tell.
We need a scoreboard. But essentially, recreational marijuana, that question will probably go to the voters next year. Everything else, expungement, medical marijuana, is still on a legislative track.
That's what it's looking like now.
All right. WHYY's Nick Pugliese, thanks for helping us sort through all of this.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Okay. Up next on the Radio Times Regional Roundup, State Senator Anthony Williams will join us. He is running for mayor of Philadelphia on the Democratic ticket, and we'll ask him about all sorts of issues. Keep it here. Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We have been interviewing the Democratic candidates for mayor of Philadelphia over the past few weeks, and today it is State Senator Anthony Hardy Williams' turn. If you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Anthony Williams, so good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So why are you running?
Because of the challenges that Philadelphia faces. The infrastructure here, unfortunately, is in a very deplorable state. That means potholes and dirty streets. We have a plan to clean our streets at least once a week, major thoroughfares at least once a week in Philadelphia. And obviously, fund the pothole problems that we have significantly. Poverty seems to be a persistent issue that we talk about a lot, but really haven't made much progress on. And of that, half the people in poverty are people of color, and the majority population in Philadelphia are people of color. And so that number being static is a significant drain upon Philadelphia County overall, as well as just the dignity of human beings. The level of violence is extraordinarily high without consequence, and it's been that way for a number of years. And so we can no longer just sort of talk about it. We actually have to do something about it. The taxes There's a tax assessment, which unfortunately goes up every year in Philadelphia, that many people don't understand why it happens without counsel or them being consulted. And then public schools, they need to be funded significantly in Philadelphia without raising taxes. And so in all those areas, we've outlined Williams in 2019.com policy positions that allow for Philadelphia to move forward.
Let's tackle the homicide rate first, the highest in a decade, 351 murders last year. The homicide rate has been a thorn in the side of mayoral administrations for decades. What would you propose to lessen the number of murders in the city? Where do you even begin?
So, one, we need to do what we do whenever we have an emergency in this nation. We need to draw attention to it. And for whatever reason, we have not decided that this is a crisis of emergency proportion. So, for me, I would declare what it is. We have an emergency in Philadelphia when it comes to homicides, which, frankly, should be drawing the attention of the national government, state government, and local government collectively. Unfortunately, I think if these levels of homicides had occurred outside Philadelphia County, we would have national news stories. Mm. For whatever reason, we just have body counts. And so, practically speaking, there are several things which we would do. One, we certainly would organize with experience that we know works. So when we had the highest level of homicides from gangs in Philadelphia in the 70s, we created an organization called Crisis Intervention. Out of that, you would hire, you know, gang members from the streets of Philadelphia. We need to hire people who are participants in this activity to be ambassadors of goodwill in neighborhoods because they know, frankly, a lot more of it about than you and I do. We need to create after-school programs as well. And so pre-K is very important. We'll support that. But we also need to have after-school programs for young people who need to learn beyond the hours of schooling to develop skills beyond the hours of when they would be in school. We need to have curfew centers. We also need to have places
curfews?
That, yeah, curfew centers. We used them in South Philadelphia to effect when John Street was in office. They had not just putting rounding up kids and putting them in a building. They actually had a variety of skill sets that supported children learning, curriculum, and a variety of other things.
So curfew centers, not
curfew center.
not actual
no,
curfews.
Not a curfew. Okay. No, curfew centers that would be okay. Supported. We also need to use technology. And so in all places, St. Louis has an app. When there's live shooting occurring, you can go online, tell the police officers this is occurring in your community, rather than report it and somebody show up hours or, you know, 20 minutes later. In live time, you can direct resources in an effective way across the board. We need to stop policies that divide communities, stop and frisk.
It's remained in place under the Kennedy administration, mm-hmm. obviously, with the caveat that people of color not be targeted. Since a court settlement in 2011, the number of stops has dropped considerably. So, Anthony Williams, you say there is no place for stop and frisk.
There's not. I mean,
to stop the flow of illegal
guns.
Yeah,
my mother would tell me, my grandmother would say, moving from an F to a D doesn't make it a better passing grade. Mm-hmm. The reality is in New York City, they do not use stop and frisk. Their numbers are significantly lower than ours are. And frankly, there's a way to do policing in Philadelphia that doesn't require you to sort of arbitrarily make a decision about what somebody's doing. If I could tell you that it was working, if I could tell you that it wasn't, compromising somebody's dignity and their human rights, then I would not be debating it. But the reality is we know that if stop and frisk worked, we would have a less homicide rate, but it's not working in that regard.
How do we preserve the dignity of all Philadelphians while grappling with the pressing need to get guns out of the hands of those who would do harm to others?
Two things. One, probable cause, the standard of what is a legal consideration, we need to implement. It doesn't mean you don't stop anyone. It doesn't mean you don't look at the circumstances around that person. But it does mean you have to raise a level on standard. The other comment, though, within the context of a national emergency, you know, there's a lot of conversation about gun control in America. And frankly, at some point in time, there will be a tipping line that actually moves us forward as a nation. What I'm concerned about, though, is that we're going to just focus upon what the national media has focused upon. And frankly, that's school safety in places that may be outside Philadelphia. For those who are in Philadelphia, it's about neighborhood safety. And so we need to also address in our national conversation in the state of emergency that we frankly need to push, you know, Pennsylvania forward when it comes to issues of gun control that are practical and respect the Second Amendment.
So one more quick question on this, because we have a lot to talk about. If you wanted to have a state of emergency declared in the city of Philadelphia, if I'm hearing you correctly, what would you expect from the federal government?
In terms of support? Oh, we would hope that they would provide us with financial resources so that we can outline a program that supports more police officers, more training, grassroots organizations working in neighborhoods, and more hiring of a generation that, frankly, are unemployed and doing nothing that are causing problems with our communities.
Yeah. Would you keep Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross on, were you to be elected?
I think that's premature for anybody to say. I think that, you know, the current police commissioner is doing his job. I don't know how or what is working from the context of him, what resources he may need or may not need. So that's a discussion, you know, after I'm elected.
Your crime overall is down 11% in Philadelphia since Jim Kenney took office. Does he get props for this?
No. I mean, I keep hearing these statistics about crime is down. Our homicide rate is up. Our homicide rate is up. So if you're suggesting that because, you know, people who get their bags stolen, except you do not get a pass when people are dying at a record level. Crime is up when the homicides are occurring. It is the greatest level of a crime that can occur against humanity. Another human being dying, being murdered. Domestic violence, you know, random shootings, stray bullets, as well as, you know, gangs and drug dealing, all those things are up. So, no, you don't get a pay. I don't even know why if I were mayor right now, I wouldn't be mentioning it. I would be talking about what everybody else is talking about, the level of homicides.
You mentioned earlier, you mentioned pre-K. You are not in favor of the sweetened beverage tax, which has gone to funding expanded pre-K in Philadelphia. How would you fund this?
Well, it's going to fund more than pre-K.
Yeah, well, in part, pre-K, rebuild, yeah. You know, crumbling parks, libraries, et cetera.
Not rebuild at all. It doesn't support rebuild. It doesn't. So $70 million and it costs $20 million. That's $50 million that most of us are wondering where the heck it's being spent. And that's the reality. So for me, I've said very clearly, 4,000 children in pre-K, we need about 17,000 children. We just booked.
How would you fund that?
$360 million surplus means that we're paying $20 million for 4,000 kids. We can afford to do that.
So Mayor Kenney says that money is needed in case of an economic downturn. Does the city need a rainy day fund? And if so, how much?
Well, the reality is that when you have potholes, murder rate, pre-K, your plan of a 2024 image of children, the time to spend rainy day funds is when it's raining. Now, with all due respect, people and taxpayers expect actions, not putting away money to be saved when you actually have significant problems today. So, of course, we need a rainy day fund, but does it need to be $360 million? I think we would debate that. We certainly can cover $20 million in terms of that process. When we spend $2.1 billion in terms of private sector and nonprofit funding in Philadelphia in our budget, I think we can realign our budget in a way that makes sense to spend it rationally, intelligently, not raise taxes in all these areas that I'm talking about currently.
The opioid crisis, it's still an overwhelming crisis in the city and elsewhere. How would a Williams administration begin to address it in the city of Philadelphia, and how would it handle ground zero in Kensington?
Well, a couple things. I think that we need to recognize there should have been lessons learned when the crack epidemic occurred in Philadelphia and nobody kind of recognized it. There's a class issue in these conversations that we need to be honest about. And so many of the conversations about how to deal with addiction come from those who suffered it the most early on. And when we talk about, you know, ground zero being Kensington, many of the people who are shooting up drugs are not from Kensington. And so we got to be honest about what we're going to do. We need to do much more in terms of prevention, intervention, and aftercare. We need a program that really does something with those who are in the throes of addiction, and that we send a signal that, one, our children are going to be very much more educated about the consequence of drug addiction from their public interaction in schools or libraries. Those who are in the throes of addiction, you can walk into a library, you can walk into a police station, you can walk into a fire station, you can certainly walk into any place in city government and find a way to get into a recovery house of some sort that we fund. And then lastly, when we know that, unfortunately, people may fall off the wagon, Philadelphia should be a national model that says wherever you are, if you're a city employee, if you fall off the wagon, we will support you until you. If you're traveling along the journey of recovery, we're going to travel along with you. The safe injection sites, frankly, I think are a misnomer, and that is you cannot safely inject an illegal substance in America. It is a federal crime.
The goal is to get people, you know, not only to help them to survive as they are injecting, but also to get them toward treatment and hopefully healing. So you say
I say that when people say that, then that sounds like a good concept. But the people who are involved, addicts, tell you that's not a good idea. That those who are in recovery, who've recovered, addicts, former addicts who are in life of recovery will tell you bringing drug dealers into a community is not a smart plan. Giving a drug addict a unprescribed drug is not a good plan. Simply giving somebody Narcan so they don't die that time is not a good plan. That is not a plan of recovery. That's a plan of continuation with, frankly, preventing them from overdosing. We have to have a plan that really addresses addiction.
How would you fund the plan to attack the opioid crisis in Philadelphia?
Well, one, the insurance entity in Philadelphia and the manner in which we do it, we have to come up with a plan that allows for people who are citizens of Philadelphia who are in modest income places to be supported in their recovery. We don't do a very good job with regard to that. Two, we actually have to look at our budget more practically, where we're spending our money and how we practically prioritize the recovery process for those who are involved. And then three, certainly working with those people who work for the city government in terms of their process so that we can support them as they move through it.
You mentioned poverty earlier in our conversation. You have promised to cut the 26% rate to 13%. How do you do that? That's a huge number, huge difference.
It's a huge difference, but I don't know that it's necessarily a huge number. So it's 8 years. If we kept up with, quote unquote, peer cities, we would have been about 35,000 jobs higher in Philadelphia County. You do it through a few ways. One, you grow jobs at least at average. Our average is bad compared to other major cities. If we were at average, growing jobs for people who are moving here would move up the number, obviously, for people who are moving here to reduce the level of poverty. Two, those who are actually in abject poverty. One, we have to have an administration that is seriously tracking every year how we're doing with it. So I've decided to have a cabinet-level person who's assigned specifically to the issue of tracking poverty in Philadelphia. And that means all the silos, all the institutions. Public school preparation, that means coming out and being prepared for what life presents, not as it used to be, but as it currently is. Two, job training in a real-life way that aligns itself with the private sector. Three, a municipal bank. So for those of us who know that we may not be an employee, but we can be an entrepreneur, we need to make investments, small investments in our business corridors across Philadelphia.
And how do you grow jobs in impoverished neighborhoods?
You create jobs for them. And that's what, for me, I have gray hair. So for those who are not watching, I have a lot of gray hair, right? And so I grew up with business corridors in my community employing people. And what you discover in Philadelphia County, unfortunately, many of those corridors have gone out of existence. Frankly, people, you know, black and brown folks would employ other black and brown folks, right? Lawyers, doctors, shoemakers, all that kind of stuff. And so for us, we have to support the existence of those kinds of businesses growing in Philadelphia through investing in them. And so we have entities, large entities in Philadelphia that, you know, make investments, but they frankly don't make many investments in small business, and they certainly don't make them in people of color businesses in Philadelphia. So we have to grow our business economy in neighborhoods across the city of Philadelphia.
10-year tax abatement program began in 2000, was put in place to encourage development. The city has experienced a building boom. Of course, it's, you know, the thorn in the side for many, especially in gentrifying neighborhoods. Does the abatement stay, go, or is it adjusted?
Changes. I don't think that the abatement is the problem so much as what we do with the abatement. The perception and somewhat of the reality is that most of the money goes towards high retail properties. That combined with an assessment process which is broken is causing many people to be forced to move out. I don't mind people moving in, and I certainly don't mind development. But we do have a problem with the fact that the assessment should be driven towards more working class folks, more need oriented. So we need more teachers in Philadelphia, younger teachers in Philadelphia. So we need to have an abatement in neighborhoods that encourage them to be in neighborhoods so education continues. Social workers who are overwhelmed, we need to encourage them to be back in Philadelphia and work. Police officers who have moved out, we want to give something for all of them that encourages them to be in Philadelphia. One of that would be an abatement type of program moving forward.
This is the second go-around for you in your attempt to win the mayor's office in Philadelphia. Anthony Williams, you jumped in, you know, relatively late to this raid, just before the filing deadline in March. You know, and that obviously affects your funding. Mounting a campaign to run for mayor of Philadelphia is an uphill climb. It's a challenge. Did this handicap you?
It limited financial resources. It did do that. But I will also tell you this. The campaign finance rules, as constructed, sound really great. But the truth is, and I'm not here complaining about it, you know, because I'm a person who's elected to office as well. But the campaign finance rules give advantage to incumbents. So for 3.5 years, you know, people who are in council or the mayor can raise money. If you're not an incumbent, you only get 1 year. Frankly, you have to announce and then you start raising money, right? So yeah. Those things would handicap anybody. That, though, I will tell you, the thing that I've experienced this time to have a credible campaign, which probably surprises a lot of people, is that grassroots are really engaged this year. And so John Street, Brett Mendel, Black Clergy, Philadelphia Mag, you know, PGW, I mean, Philadelphia Communication Workers of America. Yeah. There's a number of endorsements which we've gotten just from the grassroots.
So the fact is, though, since two terms were written into the home charter 70 years ago, no mayor has been unseated and seeking a second term. Again, you're late to the race. Are you optimistic?
Well, they kept saying that on the radio about Tom Wolf, too. Oops. So I would say it's not a matter of whether I'm optimistic. I just tell you that, and I can't predict an outcome, but I will tell you that people are much more receptive than most of us would expect, and in places that you would not expect. I was in Girard Estates last week, you know, at a town hall meeting, and I will tell you it was a lot more receptive than I had anticipated occurring. I was in the Mayfair Diner in you know, Northeast Philadelphia, and many people were very receptive in taking literature. We were in the Northwest the other day at a few churches, and so I'm not sure how people know, but they know a lot more than I would have anticipated without doing, you know, commercials on television.
State Senator Anthony Williams and candidate for mayor of Philadelphia. It was a pleasure. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Just ahead on Radio Times, we talk about some changes ahead for the Reading Terminal Market. General Manager Anuj Gupta will be with us for that. Stay with us. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. The Reading Terminal Market has been an iconic Philadelphia landmark for well over a century. Initially constructed beneath the tracks of a railroad terminal, it has alternately survived, thrived, adapted, and changed over the years through the Great Depression, the World Wars, and the demise of the railroad itself, the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad Company. Now we have word of a new development called the Filbert Street Transformation Project, designed to make the area just outside the market accessible to pedestrians or vehicular traffic, depending on the need, adding 15,000 square feet of public space. This follows a trend in urban areas across the country to provide more pedestrian-friendly areas. And here now with us in studio to tell us more is Anuj Gupta, General Manager of the Reading Terminal Market. Hello.
Good morning, Mary.
So before we get to the project, describe the 1100 block of Filbert Street alongside the Reading Terminal Market. As it stands now, during a typical day, cars, buses, trucks going back and forth, walking around.
It's a multi-purpose street in its current status. It's a one-way thoroughfare, connects 12th to 11th Street. It is also a critical connection between Jefferson Station, which is vital to our customer base, and the market itself. But in its current state, it is dark, it is dingy, it is underutilized. And frankly, for many years, and we know this from data we keep on our entryways, people have avoided going through our Filbert Street entrances, and they've gone down our entrances along Arch Street or 12th Street because of the conditions that have persisted there for too long. And at the same time, it's the market's front door.
Yeah. Are people sometimes dodging cars as they're being crossed the street to get there?
I will attest to it personally. I take the train into work every morning. Yeah. And I come out of the Jefferson Street entrance, I peek my head around usually a large delivery truck, and I run across the street. That is not a sustainable situation, and that's not what we want to create for our customer base.
So tell us about the vision of the transportation project.
So the Filbert Street
Transformation Project,
Filbert Street Project started 4 years ago pursuant to a grant we got from a national consortium of funders called Art Place America. And it was intended to catalyze public space development with an infusion of public art. Now, what we did through several years of what I would call R&D on the street, we did extensive interviews with stakeholders. We did experimental programming on the street. We did a traffic study. And what we concluded was we had to figure out a way to create a great public space and still allow for all the street's functions as currently exist to continue in the future. That includes driving through between 12th and 11th. That includes parking on the street. That includes many of the functional uses that our neighbors have from Filbert Street, like the Marriott Hotel, so on and so forth. The design that has emerged accomplishes all of that. I call it a hybrid plan. So first, it creates the first curbless street in Center City. The cartway, where the cars drive down, will become flush with our sidewalks.
Okay.
The sidewalk of the market on the north side will expand by approximately 6 feet, the width of one parking lane, for roughly 70% of the facade of the market. It then curves back into its current width, and that will be an area for passenger drop-off and loading. It will also be a rideshare designated pickup and drop-off zone. Across the street on the south side will be metered PPA parking, just as we currently have on the north side. And then we have the real estate on a day-to-day basis to activate the street, create energy around it, create activity around it with pop-up merchant carts, with more seating opportunities, with space for performers and artists, with public art on display without having to close the street down.
So it transforms. It can transform from a regular, roadway for vehicles,
yes,
to a pedestrian, kind of almost like a little pedestrian,
correct,
mall. And with the use of bollards, is that the word? Those,
yep,
are those poles that go, that, you know, can be used to block traffic.
So these are thick.
Go ahead.
Thick iron poles.
Okay.
They mark out the sidewalk from the street. When we want to shut the street down for a big event, and we do have several annual events, we do our ice cream festival is now the country's largest. We have an annual harvest festival. All of those require the street in its entirety. Now, when we collapse the bollards into the street, we have one flush event space. There's no grade difference between the sidewalk and the street, which I can tell you right now creates some serious program challenges in addition to a tripping hazard when we do have the street closed for activity.
Sure. Is that mechanized, the bollards going?
It's manual.
Manual,
but
okay.
Unlike having to lift them up and cart them away the way most bollards are treated, these will fold into the sidewalk.
And this follows a trend elsewhere in the city. There are other spaces that are being transformed, I understand, to public spaces, maybe not perhaps like is exactly like Filbert Street, but
I would say Philadelphia is in the middle of a really exciting movement of public space engagement, and you see it all across Center City. You see it outside the 30th Street train station with the porch. You see it in neighborhoods, but this will be the first curbless street. And I can tell you the city of Philadelphia is excited about this because they are looking at this as a potential model for other areas, whether it's in Center City or neighborhoods, I'm not sure.
There was no thought to make that 1100 block a permanent pedestrian plaza?
When we studied the street, and like I said, we spent about a year doing our due diligence, we concluded there was no way to permanently shut it down. There are just too many functions that the street services. And there's no ready solution. If you were to shut the street down to traffic, how do you provide for those services?
So when exactly, I know you have events at the Reading Terminal Market. Yeah. When were you planning on doing this? Every month, every 3 months, or just?
There's one of the conclusions we reached in the research process was it takes a lot. When you shut the street down, it takes a lot of activity to make the street full. In the summer of 2016, we did a program with the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. We did a monthly flower market out on Filbert Street. And on the subsequent weekend, we did an arts and craft festival. It was called Franklin Flea. And the conclusion from both of those events, we did them both over the course of the summer, was that you really have to have a ton of activity. Franklin Flea had close to 40 arts and craft merchants. That's what you need to make the street feel full.
Okay.
And we simply don't have the staff capacity to do that on a regular basis if we wanted to. The hybrid approach creates the environment that we are trying to create outside of the market. The essence of this, we are taking the magic of the Reading Terminal Market. It happens every day in our four walls, and it is spilling out on our sidewalk.
And the art's going to be there permanently, though.
We have several fixtures that will be permanently part of this. We have a gentleman, his name is Jason Roberts. He's a metal fabricator in Port Richmond, and he's going to create replicas of Reading Railroad train cars. They are going to serve as part of the modular street furniture that's out there. But in addition to that, we expect to program the space with artists, with performers, with musicians that helps to enliven the street, create the environment that we want.
So one quick aside as far as Jason Roberts' work, you said it's going to be part of the furniture? I mean,
yes.
Are people going to be able to sit in?
They will be able to sit on the train cars. We will have high tops out there. If they want to dine outside, they will be able to do that. And at the same time, because we want to maintain absolute flexibility with how we use the space, anything and everything that we put out there will be modular. Mm-hmm. Nothing will be permanently fixed to the sidewalk, so we can have as little or as much of it as we want. We can change the configuration based on what we're seeing in pedestrian behavior out there. And when we want to have a big event, it can all be removed and replaced with whatever the event calls for.
And Mural Arts is involved as well.
Mural Arts is involved with what I'm calling the first phase of the Filbert Street transformation. Right across the street is a big vestibule entrance to Jefferson Station. For too long, it has just been it's sort of a big lobby with no character whatsoever. Lots of blank space on the walls. Jane Golden, being the visionary that she is, came up with the idea to do a mural which tracks the progressive history of the market and simultaneously the progressive history of the railroad. And we will be dedicating that mural in short order, about 3 or 4 weeks. That's the first phase of doing this transformation. It's not just the streetscape as well. It's everything that we can influence and touch in the area.
Anoush Gupta, earlier you mentioned, I think, a consortium that got together to help fund this. Was it hard to get the money?
The Art Place grant is a very competitive grant. It's a national pool of money. And yes, we were one of the fortunate few to get that allocation back in 2015. All of the funding that we have also gotten for the construction subsequent to that from the Knight Foundation, from our local William Penn Foundation, and now from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, those are also very competitive pools of money to apply for. So we feel honored and privileged to get it. I also think it's a testament to the project itself. This is the country's greatest market, and this project is part of the solution to make sure it stays that way for another century.
I will say congratulations are in order because the Reading Terminal Market was named the number one farmers market in the country.
Yes.
On a list that names the five best by the online farmers market.
Yes.
So that must have been fun for you.
It was. Yeah, we were very proud of that.
Food critic Craig LeBan wrote recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer in regard to the Reading Terminal Market, quote, "By some standards, this local food paradise, an essential crossroads for a diverse slice of Philadelphians, remains as vital as ever, with 7 million visitors spending $64 million at its 80 vendors in 2017, the market's busiest year to date." Mm-hmm. However, he goes on to say that the Reading Terminal Market's modern challenges are greater than ever, with new retail markets nearby, online shopping, and a surge in new upscale food halls, which are courting the market's brisk lunch business. You're nodding your head. So
yes.
What do you see as the market's modern challenges, and how are you dealing with those?
Craig is absolutely correct. The competitive landscape we face as an institution is really unrivaled. In my 4 years as GM alone, here's what we've seen just in Center City. The emergence of Whole Foods, flagship store for the Mid-Atlantic states, about a mile from us in Fairmount. Mom's, a chain out of Virginia, opening across the street from us. Sprouts, a chain from the West Coast, opening abroad in Washington. Target now with 6 locations in Center City, all with basic grocery options. Giant just opened their first Center City location with plans for 4 more. Trader Joe's has announced thoughts to open their second store 2 blocks from us.
Are you sleeping well at night?
Well, I don't, because despite the on its face measures of success, yes, we had 7.3 million visitors. Yes, we have 80 small businesses employing 350 to 400 people. The core of the market, which is yes, we are proud of our cheesesteaks and our pretzels and our various ethnic foods, but the core of the market is for it to be a place where local residents can access fresh foods on a daily basis. And we are definitely swimming upstream in that regard. The reason tourists come to the Reading Terminal is because they know it's still an authentic Philadelphia institution. Why is it authentic? Because we are still serving that purpose. There are many places called public markets around the country that have become essentially food halls. And we are doing everything we possibly can to make sure that doesn't happen. We still want to be a place where folks can get the best quality fresh meats and fresh produce, cheeses, seafood, etc. We are one of the largest redemption sites for the SNAP program, Supplemental Nutrition Access Program, otherwise known as food stamps, in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And that's a very critical civic role that we have for food deserts that still populate our city, neighborhoods across our city that either have no choice at all or the choices that they have, they don't care for. And so those citizens in those neighborhoods still access the market regularly.
And they can find reasonable prices.
And they can find reasonable prices.
So specifically, what are you doing to address these challenges?
There's quite a bit. I mean, we have focused on sort of three main themes. One is making sure that we get the basics right. When folks come into our building, as much as possible, they expect a clean, safe, and high-quality customer experience. We're also focused, when we bring new merchants into the market, we're focused on new, exciting, innovative concepts. The way I describe it is, I want a concept that you're going to have to come to the market to patronize because you're not going to find it anywhere else.
Such as?
Well, the last one, permanent merchant we opened, Love Vegan Deli. It's a great story. It's a family in Bucks County. They're originally from Argentina. They went vegan several years ago, and they developed a line of vegan take-home foods, vegan cheeses, vegan meats, vegan burgers, soups, salads, whole nine yards. And we brought them into a Descartes program, which has also been an opportunity for innovation at the market. They just blossomed. They were a home run from day one. And we moved them in August of 2018 into a permanent space to become the first vegan deli in the city of Philadelphia. If you want vegan groceries, you want vegan cheeses or meats by the pound, you can come to the Reading Terminal and get it.
So you're looking for cutting edge and maybe a little bit different.
Exactly. That's how we would distinguish ourselves from our competition. And at the same time, maintain the commitment to our owner-operator model. So the person that sells you the sausage, they made it, and they open the store in the morning, they close it at night. That is also what distinguishes us from everyone else.
Anuj Gupta, we have an email from Richard who says, permanent trees and a green park without the bells and whistles would work better. People want green spaces, not simply more fairs, pop-ups, etc. Is incorporating green into Filbert Street something that's crossed your mind, or is it possible?
The design team does have intention for modular planters, which would have certain species that can survive and grow despite the lack of sunlight. Remember, that street is completely covered by the overpass, so it can be quite dark under there. But they have identified certain plants that could work, and ultimately that's intended to be part of the plan. But we can't green the space. It's still going to be a pedestrian plaza and public street.
5 years, where do you want to see the market?
I want the market to still be known as a functioning market that Philadelphians come to for their everyday needs. And if we maintain that status, we will not only, in the wake of all these competitive threats that we are facing, we will still continue to be this number one tourist destination in the city, and we will have our ranking as number one farmers market.
Anuj Gupta, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Anuj Gupta is General Manager of the Reading Terminal Market. Don't forget to follow us on social media and to check out our podcasts. Simply head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers are Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.